Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics. Ray, we need to talk about AI.
We do, we do, we definitely do. AI is everywhere. Yeah, hit me, Josh. What have you got?
All right. So like you said, AI is everywhere. And I think like AI is a huge problem. And I think that is the part that doesn't get talked about enough kind of in general conversation, right? Like specific people like you and me are always wailing and gnashing our teeth about how AI is a problem. But I think in quote unquote polite society, we're not having these conversations. You know, the discussions of AI are like on one hand, you know, you have the breathless true believers or whatever talking about how like AI makes them a 10x programmer and how amazing, you know, vibe coding is and how ChatGPT is, you know, ChatGPT will become God or whatever they think. But I think like any discussion of like the downsides of AI tends to get tacked on just as a coda at the end. You know, somebody's like, oh, I did this amazing thing with AI and it was so much fun. And of course, I know there are problems, you know, full stop. So like we don't go into the problems. And that's what I want to spend some time doing together with you, really drilling down on like, okay, what is AI and why is it so problematic? And I think it's not for the reasons that most people think, to be honest.
I think, I think the other thing is that AI is being pushed very hard. It's the its ubiquity is not accidental.
No.
You know, and I think that's obviously something we're going to dig into a bit more deeply. Is there is a huge investment by powerful companies and now governments. Who have been sold the idea that this thing will radically improve all kinds of organizations, all kinds of bureaucracies, and bring all kinds of benefits to society. So, you know, the narrative that this might not be true is we're pushing up quite a strong, quite a big hill here because there's a huge amount of, I'm going to say propaganda because that's really what it is.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Around the benefits of AI. So yeah, I think it's important for us as skeptics.
Yeah.
And as, but also not skeptics in the sense that we don't know what it is.
Right.
But skeptics in the sense that we can look at this thing and essentially say the AI has no clothes on, you know. Like the emperor has no clothes. It's the same kind of thing. Anyway, yes. So I completely agree. I think it's a very important subject.
Yeah. And I think like to your point about, I mean, there are skeptical voices out there, right? Like you have, you know, tech won't save us. You have this machine kills and like Ed Angueso Jr.'s writing on the subject, which is quite extensive. You've got, you know, Brian Merchant, other people talking about this. But I would say by and large, the kind of tech critical voices that are talking about AI, they are not software engineers, right? These are not themselves tech workers. They're journalists and they're really good journalists. But I think that's where you and I may have something to offer just our perspective as tech workers. I think that's why we want to talk about AI.
Yeah, I think the other side of this AI discussion that does get some airing are from people who believe that AI will like take over the world and destroy it.
Right.
You know, so this, I would say there's sort of, there's a kind of like AI as God, AI as a kind of, the other side of that is that people talk about AI as yeah, like a Sorcerer's Apprentice type thing, where it becomes a runaway, it runs amok.
Right.
And destroys, like you were saying, like Skynet or something like that, where, and there are some of these AI people who look at that side of things, as a sort of potential risk of AI.
Right.
And there was a kind of attempt by some of these companies, including OpenAI and Google and Microsoft, to have an AI risk team.
But
bizarrely, those people have all, you know, and like the ethical AI stuff.
Exactly.
Was a thing. And so those kind of groups, you know, there is a sort of voice there. But a lot of those groups have now been basically made redundant, just dropped.
Yeah.
Because various reasons. There's some politics around this, which is that there are various leaders in America now who don't want to like have woke AI, whatever that, when we'll come on to digging into that in a bit more detail about what it means, how AI can be biased and not biased and all this kind of stuff. And we'll come into that in a bit more detail.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like there's a real AI is going to destroy the whole planet, or AI is going to make us code faster. But the other thing, I mean, obviously people talk as well, and it's something we want to bring into it, is this the pure cost in terms of you know, the investment, the infrastructure, the data centers, and all of the kind of attendant externalities, all of the waste and the heat and the water and all of those things.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge investment, a huge cost.
Exactly.
For a better word processor. It just seems ludicrous. So we need to reset the conversation a little bit. And I think the fact that we're software developers, that we know a little bit about this stuff, we know definitely a lot more than the general public know about it. We know, neither of us are AI researchers or AI experts, but I think we know enough about the technology to speak with some degree of authority about what it's capable of and where the bullshit is and where the likely benefits are. And again, it's a bit wrapped up in mystery. There's a lot of hype around it. There's a lot of breathlessness. In the same way as Elon Musk has been talking about self-driving cars for so long that never seemed to materialize.
They will next year though, Ray. Next year.
Next year. Yeah, exactly. So I think we are, I wouldn't say uniquely able to speak about this, but you know, we definitely have some ability to talk about it and to contribute, like you say, to those journalistic voices who have some skepticism. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about it more for sure.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's a great point that like we're not uniquely suited to talk about this, but you know, it's the classic case of like looking around, seeing a problem and saying, oh my God, somebody should do something about this, right? Like at some point, you yourself should just step up and do something about it, even if you know beyond a shadow of the doubt that you are not the best placed person. You know, like just you and I just, you know, we've had these conversations over the last few years, but we don't need to convince each other, right? So like putting our voices out here in public, even if our voices are like not the most authoritative on the subject, I think like what we're trying to do is provoke a conversation, right? Especially among our people, because one thing that I find really depressing, to be honest, even in the somewhat niche programming community that we're part of, is the general tone when people write blogs or whatever about AI is like, look what amazing thing I was able to do in 1 hour with AI that would have taken me 27 years to do otherwise. And like, wow, this is great. And it just like, it's super depressing to be honest. And, you know, usually, like I said, at the end of those blog posts or whatever, there's that. And of course there are problems with AI .. But, you know, you just went through the enormous cost to, you know, the environment and actual like money being expended. And I think to .. or hand wave that is just like, it's irresponsible, and it really makes me somewhere between sad and angry that this is the discourse we're having.
Yes. I think what happens with a lot of programmers, you know, they look at things like AI, and obviously it's around software, it's something new, it's something novel. A lot of people in the software world want to try new things. They want to like extend their own knowledge. They want to be relevant, basically, you know. They either want to acquire skills that make them more kind of their skills more tradable at work. So they want to learn a bit more about how these AI tools work so that they can integrate them into their product. And also that, but that's true, isn't it?
I know, but that's another, like, that's such a ridiculous thing. Like, you know, AI is a solution looking for a problem in so many of these product companies. You know, I've seen this, you know, with my friends, I've seen this firsthand, where it's like the way people are talking about this is like, hey, where can we use AI? How can we use AI? And it's like, no. Like, as a responsible technologist, you know, I have to see AI as a potential tool in the toolbox, right? But the way I talk about it is like, we need to start with the problem, and we, you know, we shouldn't go looking for problems that we can solve with this technology. What we should be doing is looking at the problems that most matter to our customers and thinking about how we can solve them. And like, yes, maybe AI could potentially be one of the things, but usually it's not. I mean, almost never is it, to be honest.
I think what's happening with a lot of people is that they're seeing the board of directors or their company leaders saying, we need to have an AI story. And the reason for that, the reason they need an AI story, is because if you don't have an AI story on your product page, then you're seen to be somewhat irrelevant. I mean, you know, and this—
By whom, though?
Yeah. I know. By whom?
Investors.
By investors. Yeah, by investors. You know, and if you don't have an AI story, then, and why are investors interested in this? Investors feel like using AI will improve their return on investment.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
So that's the, I mean, we have got no evidence of that yet.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure we're ever going to get any evidence of that.
No.
Which is strange. I'm not saying it's entirely new, because sometimes it requires investment in technology to get an ROI. But usually when things have arrived at this kind of scale, there are plenty of examples of, we use this technology and we save this much percentage and that much percentage.
Right.
The thing that's really scary about this iteration of technology, of this AI technology, is that we've got no such examples.
No.
You know, everything is built on a promise of future productivity gains. And that's kind of weird, I think.
It is.
You know, because it's not normally with this kind of, and I think we need to talk about that at some point, you know, about how the marketplace is becoming, I would say, very close to monopolized by a small number of large companies that drive the narrative. And this makes it quite difficult to resist. Because again, you know, I've worked in companies, you've worked in companies where like they will have initiatives on an annual basis and they will say things like, oh, we need to evaluate crypto. We need to evaluate AI. We need to evaluate, we need to evaluate, you know, various things.
Yeah.
I'm struggling now to think of another technology that people want to evaluate. Well, maybe it's the cloud was a good example.
The cloud. Yeah.
The cloud, I mean, this is, and what's interesting about the cloud to me, if we come back to my ROI thing, is that people can immediately see, oh, if we don't have to invest in real hardware on our data center, then that reduces our capital investments.
Exactly.
And we're paying in rent, but rent over a year may be more flexible. You know, the costs might be a little bit higher, but you can see that you've got a lot of flexibility in terms of how you allocate your money, you know, capital versus operational cost and these kind of things. Yeah. So you could see a discussion there. I mean, again, whether you actually save money or not, you might become more nimble as an organization.
Exactly.
There are definitely interesting benefits around that, the cloud story.
Oh yeah.
You know, or
sure.
Or if how do you make your product available on a mobile device versus
right.
the web?
Right.
You know, those kind of things can bring value. Again, they may actually add cost, but they may broaden your market, or they may make access to your product more, make easier to access your product. So therefore you'll increase your sales.
Exactly.
So you can imagine all kinds of situations where leadership or investors can see the benefits of a particular technology, mm-hmm. you know, either for growing the market or growing market share or improving productivity or being more flexible.
Yeah.
But crypto and AI are great examples, I think, of things which hold out a promise of something,
right.
but have got no evidence yet of being able to deliver on that. And that's quite shocking,
exactly.
actually. I think that's probably, I don't know about you, can you remember a kind of technology like that where there was so much hype, it was so broad, the hype, and yet it was so disappointing? Crypto is the most recent example to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can't think of examples myself. I feel there probably are examples that we're not thinking of. But I think just to come back to what you said about scale, I think that's a really good point, because usually by the time we've reached this kind of scale, we've seen, like you said, we had a success in the small scale, and it's been kind of gradually scaled up. And I think the cloud is a really good example of that, right? Where, you know, the cloud started with, you know, with just storage in the cloud, right? Large, highly reliable storage in the cloud. So now you don't have to buy really expensive network storage devices in your data centers. And then, okay, that was quickly followed by compute, where, like you said, what you're paying for really is the flexibility, to be honest. Yeah. But, you know, Amazon didn't just roll out this enormous infrastructure and say, look, you know, if you use all of this stuff, magic will happen. Like, it was actually proven each step of the way, right? Whereas with AI, it's exactly as you say. Like, what we have effectively, we have ChatGPT is a parlor trick, right?
Seems to be.
And this parlor trick was used to, like you said, show the promise. And it's like, in order to deliver on this promise, we have to build massive scale. Like, we haven't actually delivered anything yet, but just trust us, it's coming.
Yeah, that is definitely unusual, I think, that the amount of investment, the amount of machinery that's required to make this thing viable, and the amount of data that's required to make this thing viable is...
I don't think it ever will be viable, though.
Well, I was just going to say it. The amount of stuff that's required to make it viable makes it impossible to actually deliver.
Right.
But it's one of these things where, like as with anything, it's very hard to prove a negative.
Right.
And
right.
if you've got enough hype, enough belief, and it definitely feels, and it's kind of weird, given the fact that we perceive ourselves to be a scientific community.
Right.
You know, it's called computer science.
Uh-huh.
Although, as you well know, mostly computers don't exist in any meaningful way, and there's very little science. So computer science is a bit of a misnomer. But yeah, computer science at least implies a certain amount of rationality.
Right.
It implies, certainly at least as practitioners, we like to think of ourselves at least
logical,
you know,
scientific, etc. Yeah.
Logical, scientific. We have experiments. We prove their worth.
Right.
And then we move forward based upon data.
Right.
You know, we see the numbers. We see.
Right.
We see. Oh, okay. With this particular experiment, there we can see that the numbers are impressive. You know, that we're solving problems more quickly or more scalably or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we try to be evidence-based where we can.
Yeah.
And like you say, we try to define problems quite specifically.
Right.
That we can define answers for. And it feels to me like we're in a difficult situation here where, A, the problem is not well defined, so the measurements can't be made specific enough to prove that it's not working. And maybe that's a good place to start the conversation about what exactly are the problems that this thing is trying to solve?
Yeah.
And then how does it measure up against those particular things?
Yeah, I think that's a great angle because I think both you and I are committed to good faith discussions. And one of the goals of this podcast is to start those discussions in the communities we're in, mm-hmm. communities of software developers, of technologists, because I definitely feel that these days, you know, in broader society, it is becoming more and more difficult to have those good faith discussions.
Yeah, we used to disagree on policy prescriptions. You know, we used to generally agree on facts as we saw them. But now I feel like reality is under contention. Science itself is becoming more and more fantastical, I would say. Multiverse theories and stuff like this.
Right.
It becomes very difficult to think of it as a fact rather than a sort of philosophy or some sort of fan fiction almost. You know? But obviously, we still know that even E equals MC squared feels like it's fantasy now.
Right.
And you know, there are sort of natural sciences like biology that are being politicized. What is a woman? We don't care about facts anymore. Science seems to be confusing for people.
Right.
People don't want to know what germs are or what viruses are.
Right.
And also, from a technical perspective, we have these algorithmic bubbles on all the social medias. I mean, algorithmic bubbles, it could be cozy, you know, but it feels like the bubbles are always polemics. They're always someone destroyed someone else. Someone is revealed, someone is exposed. It's all basically tabloid headlines.
Yeah. Given that reality is itself, like you said, under contention, I think it's important that we actually lay down some ground rules so that we can start from a common place that we agree on a base reality. And then we can take our discussion from there. So let's just work through some of these things. So where would you start?
You know, to quote Sarah Connor, there is no fate.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Well, the outcomes are not predefined and we can change things. And I want to not be cynical. I want to be skeptical, but I don't want to be cynical. I don't want to give up. I don't want to accept that this is the way things are going to be. We don't accept that the outcomes are predefined. Human agency is real. That we're still, you know, although reality is under contention, the future is also under contention.
Yeah.
And we've got a part to play in it. The other thing that I believe is that there's no external being or force controlling the world. So I'm not saying that we can't believe in God or we can't believe in the force of nature or the universe, Gaia, all that kind of stuff. I completely get that there are forces beyond our imagination. But the concept that we're either under God's control or in a simulation, I don't think we can accept those as part of a good faith discussion because it kind of removes all human agency.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I like what you said about the fact that this doesn't preclude there being a greater power of some sort. So I'm perfectly happy to engage in discussions with folks that are coming from a kind of spiritual or religious tradition.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, speaking of these spiritual and religious traditions, I think at their core, they are based on this idea that humans are made and should be treated equally. And I think that is like such a key. So just to dive into, you know, what we mean by made and treated equally, we reject this idea that you can break humans into categories, right? Whether those categories are races, whether, you know, it's labeling somebody a terrorist, you know, murderers, immigrants as subhuman or animals or something like.
Yeah, or a super race.
Absolutely. You know, this kind of intentional classification of humans has been used cynically, right, as a tool of power. Looking at people, we can definitely debate their actions, right?
And
we can disagree on whether what they're doing is right or wrong, but we cannot remove their basic humanity. And that applies to any person. Right. Even the kind of those in power whose actions we absolutely despise.
Yeah. As soon as people try to remove other people's humanity, the whole dehumanization thing I get off the conversation at that point.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not prepared to accept that other people are human beings.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and also this concept of like there are good people and there are bad people. All of these kind of things we have to just put off the table.
Yeah. It's like now you have this lens that you're placing, right? So you've predetermined this is a good person, this is a bad person.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you're viewing their actions through this lens where you're just inflicting this bias on yourself. And like to go back to what you were saying before about agency, in a way, you're reducing this person to their innate bad person or good person, right? If we kind of zoom out from the individual person, I think also if you look at policies, right, these really broad things, like these are choices made by humans, right? And these are not indelible. Yes. These can be remade. And we should look at policies and decide if these things are contributing to or detrimental to human thriving.
Yeah, we're living in a very complex society. And the way that we run society is we decided that. So let's not forget that we decided it.
Exactly.
It wasn't ordained.
Right.
It's very difficult to change these things sometimes. In particular moments, it's very difficult to change them. But things are not immutable. They're not untouchable. They're made by human beings. That's the place where we come from. If humans made them, humans can change them.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And so we have to be careful with our evidence.
Right.
I'm not a kind of do your own research bro.
No.
And it's impossible. You know? Yeah,
it is impossible.
In a complicated society, we're going to have to grant some trust somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe one last kind of rule of engagement I want to lay out is just the idea that, okay, so computer systems are better than humans at some tasks.
Yeah.
But in terms of innate value, you know, humans have this innate value, which is our humanity.
Yes.
I think it's really interesting when we talk about what intelligence is and this idea of artificial intelligence. If intelligence is the ability to solve tasks, then that's one where, okay, you can say that computers are more intelligent than us in some way. But if you define intelligence as the ability to exist in the world, to take in sensory perceptions and translate that into some sort of worldview, you know, I think that's what it is to be human. And to me, that definition of intelligence resonates a lot more than just this monkey solve puzzle type thing.
People want to reduce humanity to data and to tasks, essentially to a bunch of algorithms. You know, they talk about our brain as if it's code and that we have operating systems and stuff like this. I understand the power of analogies.
Right.
But we have to understand the limits of analogies as well. Because you get dangerously close to saying that computers are human, or that human beings are just less good computers. And I think this is where we start to get into dangerous territory.
Yeah.
Because if we see above where people can put people into different categories, then you start putting computers and people into either the same category, or they start putting computers above people. And to me, the main limit, and I think it should be a motivating factor for all of our discussions, is that humans are above computers.
I think just to kind of wrap up this discussion of the ground rules, I think we've laid down some good ones, and we'll actually write these up and put them on the website and drop a link in the show notes.
Yeah.
Because I really do believe that if we can agree on these terms, right, or terms very similar to this, right?
Sure, sure.
Then we can have debates that will allow us to talk about human thriving, how we as humans participate in and affect reality. You know, we will debate these things, right, on what they mean.
Sure.
But I think it's really important for us to show our work, as they said in school, right? To actually make the argument to show how we reach these conclusions. One thing that really frustrates me, and this is something that we both experienced very recently, where somebody just made the assertion, you know, when we laid out some concerns about AI, somebody made the assertion that, well, I'm not worried about these things, and then completely refused to explain why they're not worried about these things. And like, this just cannot stand. Right. Because at that point, you're not having a discussion. You're making these ground truth claims without showing any evidence for those. Yeah. So what we want to do here is we actually do want to have a discussion, right? We don't want this to be a one-way thing where we're just talking out into the world and not engaging with the audience. So we are on Blue Sky. We are on Mastodon. So please do, if you disagree with us, if you're willing to abide by these rules and engage in a good faith discussion, we would absolutely like to do that because, you know, we're not infallible, right? Some of our takes will be wrong, will be bad. And it's only engaging in these discussions together that we can sharpen our thinking, sharpen our analysis.
Yeah.
I think it would be ingenuous of us to say, like, this technology has no uses whatsoever, because that's clearly not true. And to the extent of our ability, you know, I would like us to kind of engage in, you know, the steel man conversation where we acknowledge, like, hey, there could be these benefits, like these things are possible. Now let's kind of start from there and then discuss, like, is it feasible though for us to realize these benefits? And, you know, it's funny you mentioned a better word processor. Like, I think that is one of the genuine places where LLMs have a specific application. And that is, and I've heard this from coworkers of mine or friends who are not native English speakers. And they say, like, right, these Grammarly type things that give them a suggestion for improving their grammar, like, that is genuinely useful. And, you know, I think we can acknowledge that. And that's one thing where a large language model, the way it works, right, is it eats up this huge corpus of data and then does statistical predictions of what the next word or phrase or whatever will be. So if it's trained on high quality writing, it can produce that. And this is a situation in which we're not asking an LLM to be creative. We're asking it, hey, actually, like, based on everything you know, take the ideas I'm putting out here and just kind of clean up my actual words and grammar. And that's where you want to be moving toward the, like, I want to be using the standard way of expressing myself in standard language. That's what you're asking an LLM to do. And that is what it's designed to do. So it does a good job of that.
I think my view of this is that, and I think we've talked about this before, is like I think that's, it's fine to think about translations and word processing and stuff like this, but actually those tools exist within a risk matrix or a sort of, let's say, whether the document you're producing has like high or low stakes.
Right. Yes.
So for example, you know, if you're producing a government bill,
right,
then that's quite a high stakes thing.
Right.
You know, you don't want that produced. I mean, and again, maybe these LLMs can kind of help you to craft some of the text, right, to round it out a little bit or to give even a first draft. But you definitely...
Yeah, they can edit. They can definitely... And that's where they're effective. It's like, here is this thing I've written. Like,
yeah,
help me clean up the argumentation help me polish this thing that I've already written.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and so I think things like that where we can use them as like support tools,
right,
makes a lot of sense. So right, you know, where the stakes are relatively low,
right,
you could
right,
even say, okay, let the LLM provide answers.
Right.
You know, and these chatbots are good examples of that, you know, that most of the times the stakes are relatively low, especially in a public environment. But if you start to adopt them for your business,
yeah,
where you're putting them in front of customers, yeah, then the stakes increase quite a lot.
Yeah.
If you're using an LLM to determine, for example, like whether people are eligible for certain benefits, yeah, or for certain medical treatments, then the stakes become incredibly high.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that to me is extremely worrying because,
yeah,
again, normally what we would do in computer science is we would determine the reliability of a particular right, solution and then apply it based upon that reliability.
Right.
And
right,
only when things are very, very highly reliable,
yeah,
would we put them into a high stakes environment.
The other thing we do when we deploy production systems, even if we have a high degree of confidence in them, is we monitor them, right?
Yes.
We monitor and tune, and I just don't see that happening. And I think, like, I think the stakes, that's a very interesting discussion there, because you have talked about how chatbots are used, are like, I don't know, initially used in low stakes things.
Yeah.
And like, I want to come back to maybe challenging the stakes a little bit, but I think the problem is that using these chatbots in these low stakes situations builds confidence in their ability to divine the truth, right? And then you find yourself almost without thinking, unconsciously, like using those same tools, even when the stakes get higher. And like the really scary thing for me, and I'm glad you kind of mentioned using LLMs to determine whether someone is eligible for health benefits, because as we know, there was a big scandal in Australia about where they deployed a quote unquote AI system. And here it was not a large language model. This was a kind of classical machine learning algorithm that was trained to look for patterns of fraud and kick people off the benefits rolls. And I think that there was something very similar that happened in the Netherlands, but that wasn't a large language model. But flash forward to today, and that's effectively what, you know, this Doge bullshit is, right? Like, they are literally using a large language model to ask, should this person have a job? And this is even worse to me than using a kind of trained machine learning model that's looking for fraud patterns, because with a chatbot, you have zero inspectability. Whereas with your machine learning model, like, you probably can look to some extent and see roughly how the thing got to that conclusion. But with LLMs, it's just not possible to trace that back. So you get these, and we've talked about this so many times, like, simple answers to complicated questions are super compelling, but we should treat them with an enormous degree of suspicion and skepticism, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually in terms of like AIs that are rejecting health claims, what didn't United Health introduce that? The CEO that was shot.
Brian Thompson.
Thompson. I think, I'm not saying that, you know, this was the reason why Luigi Mangione shot him. I think there were other reasons, but the fact that his company introduced this AI to automatically, and it rejected claims, rejected, it was, and again, you know, it was a policy decision by the company that they were very happy with.
Yeah.
That it was increasing the number of rejected claims. Yeah. But I think they've dropped it now. But there are certainly, you know, there's a sort of eagerness to reject things and to push back on things. And the reason why I think it's dangerous with AI is because, and we've talked about this before, maybe it's not in our conversations here, but about the fact that there's and you mentioned it with this like escalating trust.
Yeah.
And the problem we have with, you know, computers these days is there is a lot of trust, and there's a lot of belief that computers are better than humans.
Right.
I think we might have mentioned it before, but like the beginning of it for me was like calculators.
Yeah.
When if you have a calculator and it can do very long multiplication or very long division, you think that this little calculator is clever.
Right.
When in fact, all it's doing is it's just encoded a bunch of mathematical rules that are mechanically quite trivial to accelerate.
Yeah.
So we know that, and because we're kind of in the business, it feels like a fairly straightforward operation.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do a really deep dive into trust next week, because I think that's conversation that I want to have.
Yeah. Actually, you're right. Yeah, let's dive a bit deeper into it. Yeah. Okay. So I think we've kind of established that we know enough about the field, at least to talk about it, to put ourselves forward.
Yeah.
I think we know that there are some dangers of AI that are like clear and present, not just this kind of dystopian future where AIs take over. I think that the more dangerous and the real danger of AI is that they take over in a lazy, facile kind of way.
Exactly.
And that's what we want to try and, I think, discuss in a bit more detail going forward.
Yeah, definitely. And I think like the whole AI take over the world. So either the idea that what these people are talking about is something called AGI, right? Which is artificial general intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have kind of two camps there. You have the camp that is talking about the benevolent God, right? We will all be watched mm-hmm. over by machines of loving grace. Or, you know, the tyrannical dictator, you know, like Skynet, you know, that the Terminators will be unleashed because humans are unnecessary. And I think, honestly, both of these kind of apocalyptic prophecies are self-serving bullshit. And they're a smokescreen to distract us, like you said, from what the actual clear and present dangers of AI are. Like the negative effects that AI is having right now on the world. And, you know, the real danger is, and I think I really like Cory Doctorow's, I don't think he invented this, but the idea of the centaur and the reverse centaur, right? So the centaur is where you have the human head and the machine body. So that's where you're talking about, like, yes, we can use these tools. And, you know, when I say these tools, I mean like any kind of automation. When we're using automation in service of us, that's a centaur. That's where we want to be. But where it's a machine head with a human body, and this is like the classic example is the Amazon fulfillment centers, right? Where it is the machine, the algorithm deciding, and the humans are just the kind of meat that goes and takes products off shelves and puts them in boxes and, you know, is not allowed to take bathroom breaks, etc. So I think like this is the real danger, right? That we keep ceding decision-making authority to machines and we ourselves become just the, you know, the meat that carries out the orders of the machines.
I think that's where these high stakes are, actually. Yeah. I completely agree. I mean, I think you've focused perfectly on that. You have algorithms driving social media content. You have algorithms driving workers in factories.
Right.
You have algorithms driving Uber drivers and Lyft drivers. And this concept of an algorithm driving work tends to drive people. You tend to find the meat is precarious meat.
Yes. Reserve army of labor. Yes.
Yeah. Typically the idea is that these algorithms drive people who, you know, for whom resistance is futile, let's say, because they're typically living precarious and existences.
Yeah.
And they're a kind of easy target for these kind of algorithms.
But that's just a beta test, right?
That's just a way of it's a way of incepting these and making people accept these algorithms and see what happens.
Yep.
Quite right. I mean, you know, we're living in a live experiment right now.
Yeah.
About how comfortable people are, how willing people are to accept these algorithms, and that's, you know, we'll definitely come on to that during the course of our conversations about this stuff, because we need to know that. We need to put that out there that this is a beta test, as you quite rightly say.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to a point you made earlier, because I think this is also, you know, following this thread of the perceived danger of AI versus the actual danger of AI. So you mentioned these AI safety and AI ethics.
Yeah.
You know, that used to exist in Google and so on. And it's interesting because AI safety is still around, right? But the AI safety people are the ones talking about AGI and the ones talking about, like, we need to responsibly govern the development of this technology. I mean, that was the pitch for OpenAI originally, right? It was
originally,
AGI will emerge, you know, we will create God. So, we OpenAI should be the ones creating God because other people are not trustworthy to do this, right?
Right.
So that's the AI safety crowd, and they're still around. The AI ethics crowd, and, you know, the most prominent example, I think, is Temnit Gebru. So she is a computer scientist, and I think electronic or elect, electronics engineer who was working at Google. And, you know, she wrote papers, you know, both internally and externally on the ethics of, you know, machine learning, basically the ethics of increasing automation in these kind of decision-making systems. And, you know, I've listened to a lot of interviews with her, and
yes,
one interesting thing is that she said, like, listen, I have never called myself an AI ethicist, right?
Yes.
I am a computer scientist and, you know, an electrical engineer. That's what I am by training. Okay, I've thought about this stuff, but don't call me an AI ethicist. That's a box that you're putting me in. And I think it's like a very intentional move, right? Like branding these people AI ethicists, because as a society, like, I think we consider ethics as kind of a luxury, right? Ethics is a thing that we worry about when everything else is fine. But as soon as the bottom line is threatened, well, you know, we have to lay off these ethicists, right? You know, as soon as they become inconvenient, we push them out. And there's not a kind of mass groundswell against this, right?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are some, that in certain fields, there do seem to be aviation, for example. Now, Boeing apart, because we can maybe talk about that because,
yeah.
You know, and it, well, I mean, unfortunately, regulatory capture is a real thing.
Yeah.
But the concept of regulation, maybe we can talk about regulation in another episode as well, because regulation is definitely something which we need to examine a bit more.
Yeah.
Because this ethicism and all this kind of stuff is based around this concept of regulation. We're living in a world where computer technologies and software leaders have wanted to self-regulate for the last 40, 50 years.
Right.
You know, the concept of regulation is something which the software field in general detests.
Yep.
I wouldn't say everyone. I mean, we're not against regulation.
Right.
And obviously, regulations, as software and computers become more ubiquitous in society, then their effects on people, their effects on society demands regulation, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, it begs it. But the quest for us to regulate things versus the desire of the capitalist owners of these businesses to avoid regulation is a battle that we're seeing play out in real time.
Yeah, and we're losing. I think that's a really interesting point. And I do want to maybe bring this conversation towards a close. And I think one way to do that would be looking forward, you know, over the next few weeks, like what are the things we want to take deeper dives into as we explore what AI is and, you know, kind of the political economy of AI. Like what are people trying to accomplish with this? And one thing we talked about is trust. And I think we should go into that next week. But, you know, what are the other things that you think we should talk about?
Well, I think certainly trust, I completely agree there. And we need to talk about how AI, all the data that AI is being fed with, is captured through various means. We want to find out about, like, well, where does all this data come from? How does it relate to surveillance and other aspects of the sort of computer world that I wouldn't say we've got used to, but that do seem to be everywhere as well.
Right.
So I think the aspect of data and surveillance in AI is something that we need to dive a bit more deeply on.
Yeah.
Because again, there are means of resisting that people can like take actions against. You know, I think we want to try and, we haven't done so well in this episode because we're just starting off, but I think what would be really good would be to offer resources and offer examples of how people can, on an individual basis, but also on a collective basis, try to resist some of these things.
Definitely.
So I think maybe we'll even have a full episode about resistance.
Yeah.
I think that would be good. We want to talk about this concept of a a neo-Luddite perspective, exactly, where we want to focus on the human flourishing rather than the wealth and machinery flourishing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think surveillance and data is a definitely an important thing above trust.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, doing a kind of focused conversation on resistance, that sounds like a great idea. And we definitely need to focus in on the environmental impacts of AI, yeah, which we've hinted at in this episode. But I think going really deep on that would be worth an hour of our time.
Yeah, I think we probably need to do a bit more of an exposition as well of the technology itself, to, you know, not to get into too much kind of nerdy bits and bytes stuff, but have a survey of how AI has emerged from the 1950s and 60s, and then through the 1980s, yeah, where there was a lot of burgeoning belief in AI, lots of investment during that time,
yeah,
and then how it,
yeah,
failed to deliver. And we hit this AI winter. And it will be very interesting to compare like the AI winter of then to the coming AI winter of now, and see how things have changed in the meantime, because things are definitely going to be different this time around.
Yeah, exactly.
And we can look into what that means in terms of maybe the vestigial aspects of this current hype cycle. Or what we can look forward to imagining will be the remainders of this hype cycle, because there's going to be something coming out of it.
Let's just hope humanity itself comes out of it.
Well, I don't think we've got any risks about that as such.
No.
There's definitely, we're going to talk about the environment and stuff like that. I don't think there's any risks of the robots coming to get us. We can dispel that immediately.
Yeah.
But yeah, clearly the costs to the cost to the planet and the costs to society are mounting. Someone needs to pull a plug on this thing.
Right.
I really believe that is going to happen.
Yeah.
Rather than pulling the plug, I think the air is going to get that out of the tires,
right,
gradually.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a massive crash, and we'll see. Yeah. It could be a massive crash. You know, things fail slowly at first and then they fail fast. So we'll see. We'll see how that evolves. But certainly the way it's going will not continue. It's completely unsustainable. Not just from an economic, environmental perspective. That's always going to be unsustainable. But it's clear that the economics of this thing are unsustainable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like we should deep dive into the economics as well. But yeah, another discussion I want to have is, you know, and I mentioned it kind of at the beginning of this conversation, is from the perspective of programmers, like, why are we doing this to ourselves? You know, why are we so excited about these coding assistants? Like, let's think through, you and I, like, what is the end game here? Yeah. Like, what is the point of these coding assistants? What are the risks there? And, you know, I think we haven't touched on it in this conversation, but I think we'll certainly kind of get into it a little bit when we talk about trust, is the erosion of our ability to do critical thinking, which is at the core of what it is to be a software engineer, right? So I would love to dig into that. Like, as programmers, what are we doing to ourselves, and why are we doing this with a smile on our face, you know?
I think, again, it's like it's sort of mixed with this high stakes, low stakes stuff. I think people, we'll dive into this in a bit more detail, but I feel like this concept of code as a fairly low-stake environment is completely wrong.
Agreed, yeah.
And it's difficult to explain to non-programmers, but a lot of programming is boring. Well, that's probably not hard to explain. they probably feel that intuitively, you know, that it is boring. But even for software developers, a lot of programming is boring. It's difficult to tell. It's boring to tell a computer, yeah, what to do. So, you know, it's attractive and it's potentially alluring to reduce the amount of effort you've got to put in to telling a machine what to do.
Yep.
But clearly, if you're not doing it right, we're seeing now airplanes falling out the sky. Yeah. We're seeing, you know, all kinds of potential harms as software plays a more critical role in society.
Definitely.
We can see potential harm for introducing, you know, bad quality into this stuff. And I'll just end on something we'll dive into a bit more detail in the trust episode, is how the British Post Office had a whole bunch of failures with their software that led to people committing suicide, to people being put in jail, you know, to an entire system being distrusted.
Yeah.
And I think that scandal will be something that we can dive into a bit more detail, a lot more detail in our trust episode.
Yeah, definitely. So I think, like, we've laid out, you know, some things here that we want to dive more deeply into. But I think one thing it's important to say at this point is, like, nothing that we've said in the past 5 minutes of what we will talk about, you know, that's not a promise. That's just an idea of things that we think would be interesting to explore. So please don't hold us to that, except for the trust thing, which we already have got some ideas on. So,
yeah, I think the other thing to say is that the technology is changing and the ubiquity of the technology is changing. The application of the technology is changing. But I think the fundamental shape of the discussion is, I think, pretty well set. I think the reason why you can always react to the news, you know, but I think what we want to do in this series is talk about the fundamental shape of how AI is affecting our industry.
Right.
And that's why I think, you know, we are well positioned to talk about that. And then also how that industry and the AI is affecting society. That kind of thing is moving very fast in the news, like you say, with Doge and all these other sort of things. We're probably not going to get, we might mention those sort of things in passing, but this is not really a news program as such. It's not a news. We're not trying to set out a news agenda here.
No.
We're trying to set out an agenda of explanation, of education, of trying to explain things to ourselves at least. And hopefully in that process, we'll impart some new knowledge and some new ways of thinking about this stuff to the audience as well.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully get some good conversations started as well in these spaces. So, I'm looking forward to it, Ray. I think this is going to be a lot of fun to work through these subjects with you and kind of challenge each other, sharpen our own thinking.
There's so many people that are like black-pilled, you know, that just assume that everything is going to be doomed, that there's no fixing this, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that is the way that, I mean, obviously it's the way that they win.
Yeah.
Is by reducing the amount of hope you've got and reducing the amount of means of resistance. You know, and I think a lot of people just feel completely disempowered. They feel like, I mean, you know, it's like flooding the zone in politics. Yeah. It's like they're flooding the zone in terms of, you know, having AI everywhere.
Yeah.
And it just then becomes a natural, normal part of existence, even though, you know, nobody asked for it. Nobody particularly thinks it's any good.
Yeah.
But it now becomes like a cost of doing business.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, even if there are sort of good things, I want to say something about the fact that, you know, the cost of this thing is so huge.
Right.
You know, we really have to not ignore that because it's... The benefits are simply not good enough, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. We want to provide the means of resistance to counteract the black pill despair bullshit, because that's how they win. So I guess then I'll see you next week.
Brilliant. This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you've given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytex on Blue Sky and at Polytex at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytex.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!